Blog Talk Radio.
Of Eastern Airlines, the EAL radio show, where we come to you each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Bill Joseph, Jan Buskai, Chuck Albright, Howard Mucci, Jim Graybill, George Jen, Neil Holland, and me, Jim Hart. We hope all the Eastern mothers had an outstanding Mother's Day. Where would we all be without them? Our phone number here today is code 213-816-1611. Let me repeat that. 213-816-1611. And be sure to press number 1 on your phone keypad to come into the queue with us. Host, how about a few remarks? Let's start with Margaret and Neil.
Hi, Jim. Before we get started, the EAL host and I would like to take a moment to send our prayers and condolences to those in Oklahoma who were injured and to the families of those who lost their lives during the catastrophic tornadoes that touched down over the weekend and today. And having said that, we're most grateful for the mid-80s temperatures here in the greater Jacksonville area. A few little clouds, sprinkle or two of rain, no complaints from us today. Neil?
Yes, it's so great to be with our listeners again tonight and the host. And we do think tonight about those that are having their lives just completely, all of their possessions. And so it's hard to imagine what's happening out in Oklahoma and those states in the Tornado Alley. So all the hosts are wishing all of the families there the best. Steve, or back to you, Jim Hart.
Yeah, Steve Thompson, how about a comment from you, sir?
Yes, I would like to echo what Margaret and Neil have said about those who have experienced such devastating losses in Oklahoma. And it is such a tragic thing, it's hard to even watch. Here in Roaring Gap, we are experiencing a dry afternoon for a change, and the temperature is 73 degrees, Jim.
Yes, Bill Joseph, tell us what's happening with you.
Well, Jim, I'm back here in Florida. I finally made the trip, got everything done. I suffered a little bit of a back injury that I'm working through, but I feel compelled to let all our listeners know that the $600 million Powerball was drawn in Pasco County, and the winner is in Zephyr Hills, has not come forward yet. Back to you, Jim.
All right. Jan Buskai, are you with us tonight?
Yes, I am, Jim. Thank you. Here in Delray Beach, we've had torrential rain with thunder and lightning. We're heading into our rainy season, as one knows, here in the southeast part of Florida. In addition to award-winning beaches in Delray City, also known as the Village by the Sea, a bustling downtown district is and vibrant nightlife and rich cultural heritage. We host numerous events and programs for both residents and visitors, if one is planning a trip to visit us here, I would strongly recommend a stop at Delray City and look up www.delraybeach.com/events before stopping in. You might find something that's of interest to you. We also have a very active Chamber of Commerce within city limits. Jim?
Yes, thank you, Jan. To our host and ladies and gentlemen, I had the pleasure this last weekend to attend my 8th Air Force reunion in a beautiful place called the Villages. It's up north of us here. It's in the area of Ocala, Florida, and that's where I met Chuck Albright, one of our hosts. Chuck, how are you?
I'm doing great. We're having a beautiful day. 73 degrees, lightly clouded, maybe a little rain later on this evening, wind about 7 miles per hour. It's not going to really affect the golf games too much and some of our outward events. I know I had a great time meeting some of your air buddies there, and they had some really interesting stories to tell about World War II. I was very fascinated with the captain there that he was telling me about his, I believe he had 34 missions over Germany. So it was a really nice time to be with you and your friends, and I come back and told some of my Air Force buddies about you.
Thank you, Chuck. The captain that Chuck was mentioning, his name was Mr. Bill Uphoff, who lives in Jupiter. Bill is now 94, be 95, I think, in 2 months. But can you imagine at age 21, he was the captain of a B-17 bomber with a crew of 10 and flying 34 missions over Germany. How many 21-year-olds today could even think about that? Jim Graybill, let us know what's going on with you.
Well, it's a beautiful day here in Lexington, guys. Temperature's around in the mid-70s. Fog this morning was pretty thick. I think the RVR was considerably below minimums, but it's cleared up and beautiful day. I'd like to throw out my condolences to all those people in Oklahoma. I just, having watched that on TV today, I can't begin to imagine what something like that would be like.
George Jen, tell us what's going on in your area.
Well, it's a beautiful day here in Bayville, and about 77 degrees right now. And having recently lived through Sandy, I live right on the water, I just cannot imagine what it must be like for those folks in Oklahoma with 300-mile-an-hour winds. We had probably 90 miles an hour here, and it's just unbelievable. I couldn't even begin to imagine what it would be like, but my prayers go out to them. And Jim, are you on?
Yes. Yes, I am. Thank you very much, George. And for me, Jim Hart, in the south of Florida, that is West Palm Beach area, we're having a week full of spotted showers and thunderstorms. Not quite as bad as where Jan Bushkai is, because I understand they had flood warnings just south of us here. But it's going to be a rainy week for us, and in a way we're kind of looking forward to it because we are actually having a drought here. I think we're something like 6 or 8 inches low on rainfall. Now, I understand that our producer has a special or surprise rendition for us. Neil?
Yes, we're trying to audition several sounds for theme music for New Eastern Airlines, or an airline that is thinking about getting into the air these days. Beautiful music has been provided, and see what you guys think of this one that I found on the internet.
Dreaming. bit of love while cruising at high altitude. Dreaming of making love with you the way we should. Closer to heaven, we're 30,000 feet up in the sky. Here among the stars, our spirits will fly.
I liked it. I think that should be the new Eastern theme song, however it belongs to another airline.
I could just see an airplane taking off with that, with that in the background.
Well, folks, we all read or saw on the Internet or TV the LOT Polish airline Boeing 767 land with the landing gear in the up position in Warsaw, Poland. The pilot did a precision gear-up landing, and there were no injuries to the crew or passengers as a result of this emergency. But do you recall the gear-up landing made in Miami on a new Boeing 727 back in 1966? Our recall of that incident is the subject of our show tonight. Steve, will you start our program?
Yes. We'd better land gear-up. With those words, it was clear that Captain Gene Young had reached the conclusion that Eastern Flight 6, with every seat filled, would have to make the first ever landing in a Boeing 727 with all of the wheels retracted, or a belly landing. Eastern Airlines was fortunate to have such an experienced crew on board Flight 6 that day. Serving with Captain Young back in March 5, 1966, were First Officer Burke Stockstill, Second Officer Steve Britt, and Flight Attendants Sandy Rogers and Linda Sigmund and Elaine Shepard, and all were veteran Eastern crew members who were based in Atlanta. Also on the flight deck were jump seaters and also Eastern pilots, Doug Lutz and Doug Mose. Ironically, Gene and his crew were flying aircraft number 101, which was the very first of 40 727s in Eastern's kickoff order to Boeing. This order, along with similar ones from American and United, had convinced the manufacturer it was economically viable to proceed with production of the second-generation passenger jet. Bill.
Gene was already a seasoned 20-year veteran with Eastern that long-ago day in Miami. And prior to Eastern, he had flown in the Army Air Corps during World War II. The Oklahoma native had entered the Army as an enlisted man in 1939, but was soon selected for pilot training and so earned his wings, graduating as a flight officer in Class 43A. During his tenure in the Army Air Corps, mostly in North Africa, he logged over 1,800 hours in the C-47 Goonie Bird, while hauling practically everything that would fit into one. This included paratroopers, supplies, wounded soldiers, and passengers, including the first group of WACs from Casablanca down to Algiers, clearly a load that was appreciated by the boys in North Africa. He even logged some combat time, too, and later as he was training the glider troops, he figured it was only proper that he find out what those fellows were experiencing, so he qualified as a glider pilot and still has the G-wings to prove it. Gene was doing nicely as a flight officer, making the equivalent pay of a first lieutenant, when to his surprise in May of 1944, he was hauled before a board and was asked questions such as, "Do you have any insanity in your family? And do you have any brothers and sisters?" His answers were no and yes, so they made him a second lieutenant. After all these years, Gene is still trying to figure that one out.
In late May of 1945, Gene and future Eastern captains Art Nelson, Philip Fitz, and Johnny Johnson, and Gil Plaster were asked to leave the Air Corps and become Eastern pilots. It seemed like a good idea, so he discharged and hired on with Eastern on June 9, 1945, as a DC-3 co-pilot. This was a good move, and for the next 20 years, Gene enjoyed his career as an Eastern pilot. By March of 1966, now captain, Gene had flown most of Eastern's fleet, including the DC-4, DC-6, DC-7B, the Martin 404, the Convair 440, the Electra, all models of the Constellation, and of course, the Whisper Jet, as we named our 727s. As a second-generation jetliner, the Boeing 727 had many innovative concepts. For example, it was the first American passenger jet to have the engines mounted in the rear. This required the fuel lines to run from the tanks in the wings through the lower fuselage and back to the engines. Also, it had a new system of air conditioning that used to bleed air from the engines to heat and cool the cabin. This required additional ducting in the belly of the fuselage, which contained very hot air. These new systems had created some concerns as to what would happen if the crew had to land the aircraft without all the landing gear safely locked down. With the combination of hot air and fuel caused the plane to catch fire as it slid along on its belly, Boeing said no, as they had analyzed the concept thoroughly and run many successful tests, but it was still all just in theory. Jan.
There was a great deal of competition to see who would be the first to fly the Boeing 727 in scheduled service. But after a series of proposed service introduction dates between American and Eastern, Eastern won the honor when in mid-March of 1964, Captain Lloyd Lake and his crew flew the first passenger on an Eastern Whisper Jet.
Sure.
Note, United...
Lloyd used to be my broker in Gainesville, Georgia. Lloyd Lake, yeah.
Note, United was having some troubles introducing their new 727 fleet and was not in the Eastern American race. Thereafter, for the next 18 months, the Boeing 727 garnered accolades for its power, quietness, and spaciousness. This was enhanced at Eastern by the great food that we were putting on in those days when airlines flying was still very special. But trouble soon came to the new 727s. Chuck?
On August 16, 1965, the Boeing 727 suffered its first fatal crash when a United crew apparently misread their older model three-pointer altimeter over a darkened Lake Michigan. flew their plane into the water, killing all 30 passengers and crew. Passenger who lost his life in the crash, Aaron Seven, former president of Alpha. Shortly thereafter, on November 8, 1965, an American 727 attempted to circle to land at Cincinnati late at night while in the rain shower. It contacted the ground south of the airport, and only four of the 62 people on board survived. These two fatal crashes came so close together, created some concern about the new airplane. Comments misunderstood by the press created the idea in the public's mind that somehow the new airplane had some bad features that were inherent in its design. George?
Then it got worse, as only 3 days later, on November 11, 1965, yet another United 727 had a fatal crash while landing at Salt Lake City. As this was another, quote, landing accident, unquote, the press and public reacted with alarm, and mutterings commenced that perhaps the 727 should be grounded until it was found out why it was so uncontrollable in the landing phase of flight. This near hysteria continued, even though a prompt investigation concluded conclusively that the fairly new 727 captain had allowed the aircraft to enter an excessively steep final approach from which he was unable to recover, thus resulting in the plane striking the ground approximately 340 feet short of the runway. Even though the 43 passengers died in this accident, it was not because of a problem with the 727. And then it happened again. On February 1966, an Al Nippon Airways 727 attempted a night landing at Haneda Airport and impacted into Tokyo Bay, about 6.5 miles from the end of the runway. All 133 people on board perished. Later investigation concluded that the crash was also due to pilot error. Jim?
By now, there were strong calls to immediately ground this apparently vast, unsafe aircraft. Of course, those that knew it best, we who were flying her, were trying mightily to demonstrate to the public how safe she really was. But many politicians, were making headlines calling for an immediate investigation and probable grounding. There was a situation only 1 month and 1 day after the fatal crash when 44 years old Eastern Captain Gene Young advanced to power. Levers for takeoff on Eastern Flight 6 on runway 27 right at Miami for the trip to Newark. With every seat filled, little did he know that for the next 3 hours he would have the future of Boeing 727 in his hands. In recent interviews with the author, Gene recalls that afternoon in great detail. He stated that when First Officer Bill Stigwell raised the gear handle, they received an immediate red light indicating that something was wrong with the right main gear. This was confirmed by Second Officer Steve Britt, who saw an additional unsafe gear and gear door light on the flight engineer's panel. Clearly something was wrong with that part of the landing gear. Steve?
Then they contacted Eastern System Control Center, and all concerned commenced work to find a way to get the right main landing gear down a lock. They followed the proper procedures for this emergency, with Gene flying the airplane and Bert working with the radios, both air traffic control and EAL frequencies, while Steve Britt and the two jump seaters searched through the manuals and performed actions at the flight engineer station. Gene stated that he was quite confident that if the normal extension system did not work, then surely the emergency procedure would get this recalcitrant landing gear to fully extend, as visual check through the viewing port back in the floor of the cabin by Steve Britt had revealed that it was almost completely retracted. However, nothing they did seemed to have any effect on the right main landing gear. All this was confirmed by Gene's friend, Captain Jim Rush, who was flying another Eastern aircraft, that had abandoned its training flight duties and was now acting as a chase aircraft for Flight 6. Captain Rush got up close for a look-see and advised that the landing gear was jammed almost all the way up in the gear well. This was getting serious now, and of course the news media and the FAA were on the scene as another 727 was in trouble, this time over Miami. No.
Upon recommendation by the System Control Center, Gene decided to dump the excess fuel and so advised the flight attendants. They made it interesting to the passengers who probably never saw it before or ever did see this again. Loads of fuel spraying out of the wingtips. Gene maintained sufficient fuel so as to try some air load maneuvers in an attempt to force the gear down to a down and lock position. After advising the passengers, they accelerated to 270 knots and pulled G's in a series of dives and steep turns. While per Captain Rush in the chase plane, this did make the gear move about halfway towards the down position, it clearly was about as far as it was going to go. So it was concluded that the flight was not going to be able to land normally.
After reviewing all factors with system control, it was decided to land on runway 27 right back at Miami, as it was a very long runway and had only a small crosswind component. And after discussions with the airport fire department, the decision was made to save the foam just in case of a fire and land on a dry runway. The only remaining choice was whether to land with the other gear up or down. As you'll recall, the concerns about fuel lines and hot air ducts in the belly of the airplane, the crew and senior pilots in system control put a lot of thought into this decision. All were very worried about what partially extended gear might do upon contacting the runway. Would it cause the plane to swerve, or would it collapse up into the gear well? However, Gene, as the pilot in command, had the final responsibility. So, recalling the flat bottom of his airplane, he made the decision to land with the other two landing gear retracted. Chuck.
Captain Young then said, "We had better land gear up." All concerned were so advised, and final instructions were given to the crew and passengers. The System Control Center made sure all was ready on the ground, and the flight attendants briefed the passengers, reminding them to lean forward with their hands against the seat in front and their heads against their hands. More on this a little bit later. Gene instructed Brett and Steve to shut down all engines and systems upon his command, which would be as they came over the end of the runway just seconds before touchdown. Full 40-degree flaps were extended, all checklists were completed, and while on the final approach, Gene made one last quick announcement to the passengers, asking them to join him in a short personal prayer. George?
As they came over the end of the runway, he calmly stated, "Now, that all electrical, fuel, hydraulic, and air conditioning systems, as well as the engines, were shut down." Gene flew her down into the concrete at about 125 miles per hour and felt a gentle bump as the lower part of the flaps contracted the ground. As he eased her on down into the concrete, he heard a noise which sounded like gravel crunching on the flat bottom of the plane. The Whisper Jet tracked right down the center line of the runway for 3,400 feet, only swerving about 5 degrees to the right as she came to a stop. Per Gene's previous directions, Bert went out his cockpit window and the rest of the cockpit occupants went out the forward door slide. There was no panic at all, and most of the passengers went out the rear boarding stairs as plenty of clearance existed there. All persons were clear of the aircraft in less than 2 minutes. It turned out Boeing was correct. There was no fire and hardly any damage as a result of the belly landing. Aside from the new right main gear door assembly, the only other replacements were three of the four flap assemblies, the keel beam, plus a lot of skin and antennas on the bottom. She was back flying in 13 days. Margaret?
Later, a passenger came up to Gene, as did many others, to congratulate him. This passenger, a priest, stated that when Gene asked all to say a prayer, he looked at his Bible and then he looked around the cabin, where he observed that every head was leaning forward and bowed. The priest was so highly impressed by this that Gene didn't have the heart to tell him that was simply the position they had taken for the emergency landing. A quick investigation revealed that this plane had just had some maintenance performed on that right main gear, and unfortunately the mechanic and his inspector had not noticed that a large pin had been inserted into the wrong slot, and this caused the mechanism to jam upon retraction, and it was clear that nothing would have gotten the gear to move to a safe position. As a result of this accident, the FAA henceforth required all aircraft having work done, no matter how minor, on the landing gear to be placed on jacks and checked for proper retract and extension of the landing gear, including the emergency freefall system. Of course, a tremendous sigh of relief echoed through the FAA, airlines, and traveling public at the safe landing performed by Gene and his crew. In record time, that very night, the FAA had its official meeting with the crew, and they were then released to fly the very next day. This was unheard of, releasing so soon, as usually after an accident or an incident, the crew was not cleared to fly for days. And at the conclusion of the meeting, the FAA inspector commented, "You've proven that this is a safe airplane, and it won't be grounded." Captain Young and his crew received many deserved accolades and honors. WSB out of Atlanta recognized him, as did many other groups. Coca-Cola noticed that Gene was drinking a Coke in one of the TV interviews shortly after the landing. They later sent him a letter asking for his address as they wished to reward him. And interestingly enough, a few days later, a truck pulled up in front of his home with 20 cases of Cokes and 6 cases of Sprites. However, what he values most was the telegram he received the very next day from the fellow who taught him to fly the 727. "Congratulations on a fine job," it said, "Captain J.B. Robbins."
Well, that's the second of the two theme songs, and we'll probably find some more, but I like both of them. As far as the program that we just presented with Captain Gene Young and Bert Stockstill and Steve Britt, I remember them well. I believe Captain Young is has passed away, as well as Steve Britt. And, of course, Bert Stockstill was the first officer on the L-1011, Flight 401, from New York to Miami. And he was killed in that crash in the Everglades. But any discussion about how Gene handled that? And perhaps, Steve, you may remember it real well. I don't know whether you were down in Miami at the time.
Yes, I do remember it. And I also remember Steve Britt's father, Mark Britt, who was a neighbor of mine who lived on Cherokee Trail in Gainesville, Georgia, right close to where your real estate office was. And I also heard your remark about Lloyd Lake, and I remember him also as being your broker.
Absolutely, yeah. He was a great guy, too, Lloyd was. And he was a very senior captain. I think one of the most senior captains in Atlanta, if not the system. But Lloyd was a fine gentleman. He really was. And I had the pleasure of having him as the broker of the office that I had up in Gainesville, Georgia. You know, this kind of reminds me of what recently happened with LOT, landing the 767, I believe, with gear up. And you know, back in those days, yes, Bill Joseph?
If we could take a second on that LOT thing, I don't know whether the listeners would find this interesting or not, but that was a 767 aircraft that they landed with the gear up, and they are to take delivery by August of five of the Boeing 787 Dreamliners. And these have been held up, of course, because of the problems they've been having with the battery systems. So I find that they will be the leading Dreamliner operator in Europe when they get those five airplanes by the end of August.
Very good.
Neil, I have a comment.
Yes.
It was always my impression that if a belly landing was to take place, the first thing they always used to do was foam the runways. Has that changed now?
Maybe I can make a comment on that, because I was on a foaming crew down in Miami, and I happened to be there one day when they did. It was a nose gear landing. It wasn't a main gear. And the foam was made, back in those days, was made out of a chemical compound that was also part and parcel of what they call ox blood. It smelled terrible. But one of the things that they did with the 727, and this is just kind of my opinion, was they chose the landing without the foam due to the engines being up high, whereas when you have the other aircraft with the engines hanging off the wings, then you would have a more susceptible to fire due to the maybe shattering the wing sections where the fuel has been in, and they would foam the runways then. That's just basically my opinion, but I heard some of the people, when we did that foaming, saying, well, this was because the plane had a nose gear, and it was, I forget which aircraft it was, which airplane, airline it was, but their engines were down on the wings, and that was the consensus that why they foamed the runway. Why they do it today or they don't do it today, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I believe that the LOT airliner that landed gear up, it turned out that entire situation could have been avoided, that there was I believe it was a circuit breaker had popped that none of the crew realized that was the cause of that. And had that circuit breaker been reset, that they could have gotten the gear down.
Yeah.
Well, just think of the light bulb on Flight 401.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah.
but I believe they also landed the LOT aircraft without foam, and that has the engines, you know, under the wings, the 767. So I don't know what determines whether or not to use the foam.
Yeah. Well, the foam that I recall is very corrosive. It chews up aluminum, something fierce, if you don't get the plane up and on jacks and washed and everything else to get it out. So it's the same way when you have the bottles go off. They use purple stuff, and it's very corrosive. But it does the job. And maybe that's, I don't know, maybe we're talking bottom line here. I wouldn't say so, safety.
Well, you know, earlier in our presentation here, we mentioned the cabin flight attendants and their names, Sandy Rogers, Linda Sigmund, and Elaine Shepherd, were mentioned in our presentation tonight. Margaret, can you give us the actual briefing that you give on the 727-100 series? Because this was, in fact, the very first 101 aircraft, the very first aircraft delivered to Eastern Airlines, who actually flew the first 727 flight. Margaret?
I'd be happy to, Neil. From the forward flight attendant seat on Series 100 aircraft, they brief passengers from row number one to the window exit row, selects and briefs able-bodied men how to open doors and operate evacuation slides and assign seats near the doors. Also ensures that slide bars are installed in floor brackets at all doors and assists the aft cabin attendant or attendants and passenger briefing and orders water bottles filled if required.
Jan, the second flight attendant, can you give us the briefing?
The flight attendant briefs passengers from overwing exits to aft row, selects and briefs able-bodied men the operation of exits to open exits after aircraft has come to a complete stop, assigns seats near exits. In addition, stows loose items in lavatories. After aircraft has come to a complete stop, opens forward entry door and inflate slide, evacuates passengers as quickly as possible, determines that able-bodied men are doing the same at galley door, checks cockpit if crew's injured, enlists aid in evacuating them, ascertains all passengers have evacuated, evacuates with removable emergency light located above door and with water bottle if required.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. Newark, New Jersey, May 18, 2013. An airline official says a U.S. Airways Express flight with 34 people aboard was forced to make a belly landing at Newark Liberty International Airport after experiencing landing gear trouble. No injuries were reported. U.S. Airways spokesman Dave Ian Anderson says a turboprop plane that left Philadelphia shortly before 11 p.m. Friday landed safely at Newark with its landing gear retracted at about 1 a.m. Saturday morning. Anderson says the flight, being operated by Piedmont Airlines, was carrying 31 passengers and three crew members. He says the plane circled Newark in a holding pattern while working to get the gear down. After several failed attempts, the plane landed on its belly. Anderson says the passengers were evacuated to the terminal by bus. He says U.S. Airways is cooperating with the National Transportation Safety Board, which is investigating the incident.
Chan, I think you have something that you want to tell us in the form of we've been talking about near disasters here tonight, and I wonder if you can.
And we have something light to say.
Light to say. That's what I'm looking for.
Right. I hope that our listeners will enjoy this. This is three older gals were chatting about the problems of aging gracefully. One said, "Sometimes I catch myself with a jar of mayonnaise in my hand in front of the refrigerator, and I just can't remember whether I need to put it away or start making a sandwich." The second lady chimed in, "Oh, yes, sometimes I find myself standing on the stairs and can't remember whether I was on my way up or on my way down." The third one responded, "Well, I'm glad I don't have that problem. Knock on wood." As she rapped her knuckles, suddenly she said, "Oh, darn, that must be the door. I'll get it."
I resemble that remark.
A good one.
Here's a little something for the men in our audience tonight. A man brings his best buddy home for dinner, unannounced, at 5:30 after work. His wife screams at him as his friend listens in. "My hair and makeup are not done. The house is a mess. The dishes are not done. I'm still in my pajamas, and I can't be bothered with cooking tonight. What the hell did you bring him home for?" "Because he's thinking of getting married."
Very good.
Well, Bill, have a story. Steve?
I have a story of three little boys that were going to the hospital the next day for operations. And theirs will be the first on the schedule. And the older boy leans over and asks, "What are you having done?" Well, the second boy says, "I'm getting my tonsils out, and I'm afraid." First boy says, "You got nothing to worry about. I had that done when I was 4. They put you to sleep, and then when you wake up, they give you lots of Jell-O and ice cream, and it's a breeze." Well, then the second boy asks, "Well, what are you going in for?" The first boy says, "Well, circumcision." "Whoa," the smaller boy replies. "Good luck, buddy. I had that done when I was born, and I couldn't walk for a year."
Great.
Oh, my God. We have a few announcements before we go off air here. And matter of fact, I think we have time to do a little bit of airline etiquette. And so, Jan, do you have that first a little bit of suggestion or hints about what you should do in the event that some travelers
have
problems with other travelers? Go ahead.
Yes. Some travelers are models of good behavior. Regulation size bag tucked easily into the overhead bins, volume on their device of choice, audibly only to them on their headsets, no use of the middle armrest, food brought on the plane is odorless or even has a pleasant scent like an apple, and never, ever do they utter more than a polite hello when they take the seat next to you. And then, of course, there's the worst airline passengers ever. They drink too much, force emergency landings. They hurl racist remarks at small children, that kind of thing. And then there's everyone else who falls somewhere in the middle. And that's where things get a little dicey. For example, who does get the middle armrests anyway? Should you say something to a fellow passenger who ignores crew instructions? What do you say to people who recline their seats into your lap? Ugh. An online unscientific survey from Travel Leaders Group poses these questions and a few more. here's what your fellow travelers have to say. Margaret?
Well, when asked, if you're seated in the middle seat on an airplane and the people on either side of you staked out the armrest, what would you do? Interestingly enough, here were the responses. Say something directly to your seatmates. Only 27.9% of the people chose that one. Call a flight attendant and let him or her handle the situation. Only 2.6. Sit quietly and say nothing. 48.9%. And not sure? 20.6%. You know, Captain Neil, I'm concerned about those people that are not sure. You know, that's one-fifth. That's quite a bit.
Talking about etiquette, there's a certain decor that goes along and is required of flight crew members. I remember one day after, as deplaning, I leave my captain's seat and go back, and I join the flight attendant who's at the door. And I couldn't believe my ear. She is saying, "Thank you very much," with a beautiful, beautiful smile. And each passenger, "Thank you very much," and I will, you can use your imagination what the blank is, but it starts with
an F. Oh, my word.
And no one caught it. I couldn't believe it because of her beautiful smile, and everybody was responding. Oh, enjoyed it very much.
You sure that wasn't on Saturday Night Live?
No, it really happened.
Jim Graybill.
I have even seen a flight attendant filing their nails as the people are deplaning. That just amazed me.
Oh, my. Jim Graybill?
Neil, I got one that I was told that this happened, and knowing the captain, I can envision this actually happening. As usually happens a lot, this lady was in first class, and she had this cat, and she was told the cat had to be in the container under her seat. Well, they get airborne, and this lady has this cat out and takes it out of the container and pit and so forth, and the passenger next to her got all bent out of shape. And anyway, long story short, they couldn't get this lady to put this cat back in the box. So the flight attendant went up and told the captain, and he said, all right, I'll be back there in a minute. So a few minutes, he gets his coat on, puts his hat on, and opens the cockpit door, and the fire axe happens to be on the cockpit side of the bulkhead. And he opens the door and stands there for a second looking around, and all of a sudden he whips this fire axe off the wall and says, "All right, where is that GD cat?"
Another Saturday Night Live.
I'm telling you. But anyway, when I ask, if the person in the airline seat in front of you invades your personal space with an article of clothing and or their hair or so, whatever the direction in front of you, what would you do? The passenger's response was, say something directly to the person, which was 68.9%, call for the flight attendant and let them or her handle the situation, was 9.3%, sit quietly and say nothing, which was 13%, and not sure, 8.8%. Again, I don't know about that, not sure.
yeah, not sure. Chuck?
Yeah, when asked, if the person in the airline seat in front of you reclines their seat so much that you're unable to lower your tray table or perhaps unable to open up a laptop, what would you do? The responses were, say something directly to the person, 55.4%. Call a flight attendant and let him or her handle the situation, 21.8%. Sit quietly and say nothing, 15.1%. And not sure, there's that not sure again, 7.7%. George?
Okay, here's a good one. When asked if the person in the airline seat in front of you ignored crew member instructions to have their seat back upright for takeoff and or landing, what would you do? And the responses were, number one, to say something directly to the person, 13.4%. Call a flight attendant to let him or her handle the situation. Probably that was like 8.1%. Sit quietly and say nothing. 50% of the people said that. And not sure, 8.4%.
I'd be inclined to be a whistleblower. Steve?
Yes. Speaking of the cat story, there was when I was in Alaska, I spoke with the pilot who was involved in this particular incident, but he's flying a beaver on a scheduled run from a local village back into Juneau. And a lady came down the ramp with a cat in her arms, and he said to her, "Ma'am, I cannot take you on the airplane unless that cat is confined to a cage." She said, "Oh, no, it'll be fine. It'll be okay. I'll take care of her." So he said, okay. He gave in, and the only seat that was left on the airplane was a co-pilot seat beside the pilot. So they taxi out on the waterway to take off. And with this, he gets lined up for the takeoff run, and he advances the power to full power. And with this, the cat becomes agitated and starts just attacking her owner, just viciously attacking, claws out. And just as they get airborne, the lady can't take it anymore, and she throws the cat over on the pilot's lap. Well, the cat then begins to attack the pilot.
Oh,
so he opens the door.
Oh, no.
And throws the cat out on the canal. Well, his response to me, "If you think the cat was vicious, you should have seen what the owner did to me. He started attacking me." And she said, "You turn this airplane around right this minute and go back and get that cat." He did so. Turned around and landed on the water and coasted right up to the cat, which was swimming, and reached down and picked up the cat and handed it to the owner. And he took off again, and the cat was just as quiet as a mouse for the rest of the trip.
Good story. Very good.
That's great.
Margaret?
Well, when asked if you were on a flight with someone who talked so loudly that half the plane could hear them, what would you do? Here are the responses. Say something directly to the person, 14.4%, that's average. Call a flight attendant, let him or her handle the situation, 27.9%, that's also average. Sit quietly and say nothing, 36%. And listen to this, not sure, 21.7%. I think I'd have to add another one, though, because I cannot sing and carry a tune. I think I would just start singing to the top of my lungs. I understand they stopped a plane or took it someplace. So that would take care of that
there
problem.
You go.
Jim Hart.
I have a good one. When asked, what would you do if it appeared that parents of a screaming child aboard a plane were not making any attempt to comfort or control the child? The responses were, you say something directly to the person, that's 7.9%. Call the flight attendant and let him or her handle the situation, that was 46.7%. Sit quietly and say nothing, 30.6%, and those that are not sure were 14.8%.
I have a footnote.
Yeah.
This really happened to me. We were flying from Miami to Boston on Christmas Day, and we were in first class section, and my young daughter had an ear problem, and of course the pressurization got to her, and she started really crying. So we couldn't quiet them down, so I took her and put me and her in the first class lavatory. Now, they could hear her probably, but a little more muffled. And I stayed there for the 3 hours and something, and I got a bottle, and she finally went to sleep, but I stayed in the lavatory. When I came out, when they said you're going to land, you have to. When we came out of the lavatory with my child in my arms, the whole first class section applauded me.
That's a true story.
Well, but who had the bottle and what was in the bottle?
That came later.
I have one quick one. I was flying an Airbus trip from Santo Domingo nonstop to Kennedy, and it was in, I guess, the early autumn up here in New York, and we departed, and when we were returning back to Kennedy, there was a bad frontal system or a hurricane, I don't recall which, coming through the New York area. So we got down about 11,000 feet coming in for approach to Kennedy, and we told the flight attendants, look, it's going to be really rough, and tell the passengers, make sure the seatbelts are fastened. So they did. And about 10 minutes later, one of the flight attendants made her way up to the cockpit. She said, George, I can't believe it. She said, but people are throwing up, and it's rolling from one side of the plane to another. I said, well,
there's
nothing you can do about it. I said, we'll be on the ground in about 5 or 10 minutes. So we landed, and after we landed, got out of the cockpit and went to say goodbye to the people. And this one lady comes up to me. She goes, you know, I mean, it was pretty frightening for the people. She goes, oh, thank you very much for getting us here safely. She said, I just want to give you a kiss to thank you. And all I kept thinking about was what the flight attendant said was going on. I said, oh, that's okay. You don't have to do that.
Oh, man.
That's good.
How come it's to me that the first storyteller on here doesn't stand a chance?
Well, that's just like at a bar. They all get prettier at closing time, don't they?
There you go. That would be Luann's theme song, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Now you hush up.
By the way, did you like the two songs that we played tonight? What did you think
I
of
like
them?
I like the first one.
The first one.
They were both very good.
I like
one. They were both good.
Yeah. And I got a couple of more. Maybe we'll play those next time. Margaret, you've got a couple of announcements before we sign off.
Yeah, I do. Actually, coming up soon is the EARA Annual Business Meeting and Luncheon at the Miami Springs Country Club on May 29th. And coffee is available at 10 a.m. I think the business meeting starts at around 10:30. And it's only $10, so that's a must. If you want to attend this, that's going to be great. And, again, that's May 29th. We do have a phone number. It's area code 305-883-6145. Let me just repeat that quickly, 305-883-6145. Call and make your reservations. And, folks, there's plenty of time to make your plans for the Atlanta EARA at the J.R. Lee Memorial Picnic. It's going to be held at the American Legion Log Cabin on State Highway 85, just south of the Fayette Courthouse in Fayetteville, Georgia. And that's going to be held Wednesday, June 12th at 11 a.m. So if you're in the area, make sure you attend that one. That sounds like it's going to be a fun one.
Jim, do you have a luncheon coming up, or have you already had that there in West
Palm
Beach?
No, in fact, we just had ours this last Thursday, Neil. And, of course, it's my farewell until fall, and we have two past presidents who will handle the meetings between now and the fall when I return. Say, I hear the champagne music of Lawrence Welk
question.
In the background. Signaling that we've come
Jim, hold on just a second. I think we have an emergency question.
Yeah, Neil, you mentioned something at the outset of the show about the book, and you said you were going
to. Yes, we have time for that. As a matter of fact, George Jen, listeners, if you haven't heard us in previous shows, wrote a wonderful book. It's called Flying Too Close to the Sun. And I highly recommend it. All of us have, just about all of our hosts, I hope, have read it by now. But what an entertaining novel, and especially about the airline industry. And it has a real surprise ending. But we won't tell you much more about that. But we do have, I think, Margaret, you brought it to my attention that on the internet, where'd you find that?
Well, I was surfing through the internet and it came on one of those news shows. I can't remember if it was Fox or CNN or something like that. But George, apparently last week there was a gold shipment coming up from South America, and it just disappeared after it was, you know, it was on the plane, then the plane landed, and then they took it off the plane on the cart, and then they found an empty cart near one of the gates or something like that. So your book is very, very interesting. It's maybe it's a how-to do.
I'll let you know if the FBI shows up at the house.
Oh, please do.
Are we getting closer to seeing this on the big screen, George?
No word yet. I'm still waiting for the first person to call me, and I haven't heard from them before I go out to anyone else.
Well, they should. Your book is fantastic. Yeah. It would make a great movie.
How about the new book that you've got out, George? Is it out now? Purchase that?
No,
tell us a little bit.
No, it's not. I had a couple of loose ends to tie up on it. I'm just about done with that, and hopefully it will be soon.
Well, how can we order Flying Too Close to the Sun, George?
Well, you can either go on to Amazon.com and order it on there, put in my name or the name or the title of the book, or you can now you can go to BarnesandNoble.com and order it on there if you put the title of the book in, either a paperback or for a Nook. So I guess it's been popular enough where at least that's what the publisher told me, that Barnes & Noble also picked it up.
If it's a book like the first one, George, you're going to be a real competitor for people like John Grisham.
Well, the second one is quite a bit different. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, but I think that you'll find it extremely interesting, is all I'll say at this point.
I'm sure it will be.
Well, Jim Grabiel, I don't know where whether you, how it got there, but your book on Flying Too Close to the Sun is in the bookstore at the University of Kentucky.
Oh, really?
Oh,
wow, that's
yay.
Nice to hear.
Yay.
Well,
that's,
thank you.
That's great.
Very nice to hear. I guess, you know, the hardest part today is doing marketing, and I guess it's kind of marketing itself because I'm going to do a couple of signings here in New York, and but other than that, nothing else plan for it right now.
Well, Jim Hart, would you take
yes,
us
sir.
Out of here?
All right. Do you know the champagne music has been playing for some time now, and thanks to Lawrence Welk, that music in the background signals that we've come close to the end of our time with you this evening. Please be sure to be with us next week when we do some interviews with Eastern people like you. We hope you've enjoyed your host presentation of this Eastern drama 47 years ago. The article appeared in an issue of Retired Eastern Pilots Association magazine called Repartee. It was written by Captain Jim Holder. Remember, you can hear it again by going to the website www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Or to the radio show's website, www.ealradioshow.com. Over 116 archive shows can be accessed there. Now, from all of the gang here at the Radio Voice of Eastern Airlines, we say good night, Eastern
good night,
people.
Good night.
Good night,
good
night,
good night
all.
Good night, all.
Good night,
all.
Good night, Jim.
Yeah.
Adios. Au revoir. I'll
be the day. Good night. Hello, this is Jim.